This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. As of today, the state of North Carolina has more than 36,000 prisoners serving in 76 prisons across the state. Most of them will eventually get out. And we call prisons correctional facilities, and it is hard to say how much of a difference they actually make, but if any change does occur, it is often as the result of religion. For some prisoners, religion is a source of spiritual comfort. Others see it as a route to more material benefits, shorter sentences, better treatment. We are talking today about the role of spirituality and religious practice inside the walls of North Carolina's prisons. And we welcome your calls this hour at 877-962-9862. Joining us now is a former prisoner who has asked us not to use her real name. We'll call her Brenda. She received 12 and a half years in North Carolina's criminal justice system. She was released 4 months ago. Brenda, welcome.
Be here.
Brenda, you had say you had strong faith before you went to prison. What did the experience of being behind bars do for your faith?
Actually, it increased it tremendously, because in that situation, you have to rely on something other than yourself. You're in a somewhat of a powerless situation, and you just can't do these things for yourself anymore, such as bringing yourself out of the doldrums, having comfort. I have to say that without some kind of spirituality, those that are incarcerated are doomed to just stay and be stagnant within that system.
Well, but how common is that to reach for something as intangible as God for relief, inside prison? How common is that?
It's fairly common. Whether they call it God or have another name or whatever their faith tradition might be, there's a time in prison when you don't have your children with you, you don't have the bills to pay, you don't have the everyday stresses, and this is a time that you can take for reflection. And I think it's very, very common when you're lying awake at night, and this is common, when you're lying awake at night and you're wondering, where am I going? How did I get here? What can I do about it? Where else can you go but to a higher power?
Well, there may be alternatives. Was that higher power your first thought as you asked those questions?
Actually, yes. Yes. I mean, I came from a faith tradition that was quite strong. And naturally, I strayed away from that, because otherwise I wouldn't have ended up where I did. But during that time in prison, I realized, or re-realized, actually, the depth of my commitment and what I owed to God, and how that, being with, close to Him would help me through this trial and, become a better person in the long run.
So is this a personal practice then, or do you get involved in religious practice with others?
Okay. Well, it starts out as a personal, feelings. But I have been involved with many of the Bible studies that have come into the prisons, Shepherd's Heart, Disciple Bible Study. That was a four-year course. And, of course, the Kairos Weekend, which these volunteers put on twice a year, is really, really an electrifying experience.
How so?
It's 3.5 days of intense retreat with 30 inmates altogether. It's only as many as allowed to attend. And it's a total immersion in God's love. The feeling of worthlessness that many inmates feel is banished for this brief time. There is a forgiveness ceremony that is done. And it's hard enough to forgive the prosecutor or your mama or your daddy or however you feel you ended up here. But how do you forgive yourself? And with that, you do need some spiritual strength. And Kairos, to me, I'm not demeaning any of the other programs because I think they're excellent, but Kairos, to me, is more of a conversion experience if it's going to happen.
How much, though, are there other material benefits for participating in Bible study or prison ministry?
In a women's facility, there aren't. I mean, you get Perhaps the guards or the higher-ups would view you, oh, yeah, that's a good person, look what she does. But in actuality, when it comes to shorter sentences or privileges or anything like that, it makes absolutely no difference. It is a personal choice.
So there's no, I mean, you don't get better food at these things? Prison ministers bring in better food, and it's not at all considered in your parole hearings?
I don't believe so. I really don't believe so. They take a look at the overall, have you been a troublemaker, this, that, the other thing. But, and they may look and say, oh, yeah, you know, she attended a lot of religious things, but I don't think it has much impact. And as far as the food, of course, you know, institutional fare is institutional fare no matter where you are. And the occasional goodies that the volunteers bring in, it may attract some, but that's all right because they're still getting some spirituality and they're watching God's love at work because these volunteers bring this stuff into us because of God's love.
We are talking today on The State of Things about religion in prisons, and for people like Brenda, spirituality is a source of comfort and strength. State of North Carolina also sees religion as a source of stability in the chaotic and pressured environment of a prison. State Department of Corrections supports about 100 full-time and volunteer prison chaplains at prisons across the state. We're joined now by two of them. Oliver Mohammed coordinates Islamic services for the North Carolina Department of Corrections, and Marilyn Gaswind is a chaplain at the Raleigh Correctional Center for Women and a former chaplain at the North Carolina Correctional Institution for Women. And Marilyn and Oliver, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Oliver, how common is Rhoda's story?
I think it's very common. I think when an inmate comes to prison, I think they are looking for something to help them cope with the issues that they are faced with in prison. Prison is a very confining place. It's a very oft-time lonely place. And oft-time, their conversion to a faith of their choice is a sign of maybe there is some desire in that person to change. However, and I know there's a great deal of talk about prison house faith and religion, and some people question whether or not inmates are really sincere after they've done something in the society that's been harmful and hurtful. People tend to question, but there is no way for us to really assess the depth or the sincerity of someone's conversion. That can't be assessed. But I do know that there is a need, or there is a feeling that most inmates I've talked to, they all feel that there's, you know, especially those who have been in the system a while, or those who have been in and been out again, they know that they have to do something with their life. They know that life can't continue going the way it's been going. And so, you know, a conversion to a faith, or associating with a faith, or reading the Bible or the Quran or some scripture tends to help that person make some kind of changes in their life.
Marilyn, what percentage of people would you say in the correction system actually get involved in some kind of active faith or, you know, spiritual pursuit?
Somewhere between 30% and 40%. There is something I'd like to tell your listeners, though, who heard Brenda speaking that would be helpful maybe for them. She talked about Kairos, and I'm sure people listening are saying, what's Kairos? And I can tell them exactly what it is. It's the Emmaus Walk or the Crisseal Walk, which all the Christian denominations have those walks. Kairos is the same thing, the same format, brought into the prison walls. And anybody that is a volunteer for Kairos has to have been on one of those walks, Emmaus, Crisseal, themselves.
It's a form of a spiritual practice.
Yes, it is.
Now, I want to ask a little bit again about the business, though, so we can maybe get this behind us once and for all. The whole question about benefits and whether or not these are considered at all in parole questions, parole hearings, or whether participation has in some way, whether one has the right to question the sincerity of anybody taking on spiritual practice. just because there are other benefits. Marilyn?
I really don't think there is much of a benefit. You have mentioned food. Yes, they do like that. But that gets old, too. People don't come week after week because of food. But no, there's very little benefit to my knowledge of.
Brenda, you served 12 and a half years, and you have said that the whole experience to you, you felt was, and I'm not quoting you now, but was a blessing, in a sense, a gift from God. And maybe you can explain that for us, how being in prison to you feels like a gift.
Okay. Well, on a day-to-day basis, it surely didn't feel like a gift.
Yeah.
But in the overall, there was a destructive quality to my life before I was incarcerated. And I'm an older woman, so I'm not just a teenager that just did something stupid one time. The emotional and spiritual benefits that I've had through this have been so tremendous. It's even hard to talk about sometimes. It really is, because it has had such an impact on me.
I'm going to hold it right there, Brenda, because I do want to talk some more about this. I want to talk about the conditions in prison and what it is that makes it so likely that one would turn to spirituality. On the State of Things, talking about prison ministry, joined by two prison chaplains, Oliver Muhammad, coordinator of Islamic services. Marilyn Gaswint is the chaplain at Raleigh Correctional Center for Women. Your calls at 877-962-9862. More of the conversation when we return. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We are talking today about religion in North Carolina's prisons. North Carolina operates 76 correctional facilities across the state, and spirituality and religion have an official place in all of them. We're joined by two of North Carolina's full-time prison chaplains. Oliver Muhammad coordinates Islamic services for the North Carolina Department of Corrections, and Marilyn Gaswint is chaplain at Raleigh Correctional Center. We're taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. Oliver, before the break, you talked about people being in prison, being now able to think about what they've done, where their life has gone, and having a little more time to do that. As a chaplain, do you approach the teaching of spirituality differently with someone who has been convicted of a crime than you might otherwise?
No, I think when you see a person in prison, I think it's just an example of the human experience. I think all people make errors in their life. They make errors in judgment. So as a chaplain, we attempt to meet the person wherever they are in their life. And we want to nurture that spark of their soul's urge to want to get close to their Lord or their God. Mm. And so basically, a chaplain is not there to help that person choose a faith, but to just to be there to help them walk through those steps in trying to find something that's comfortable.
Marilyn, in some ways, is it an advantage to have sort of an official document that convicts someone of the crime, unlike the rest of us on the outside who've committed many crimes of the heart and on earth, and just don't have that conviction, don't have a title, in terms of recognizing perhaps your vulnerability and your need for a higher power?
No, I don't think so, because I think you immediately have the people coming to you, like Brenda said, that are looking for it, much like you have in the church. The people that are looking for it come to the church, and it's unfortunate. We don't have a lot of time to go out looking for people. Our time is really totally taken up by those that are looking for us. One of the things you asked him, if the teaching was different, I'm a leader for spiritual formation classes at Duke Divinity School, and I teach grief classes at First Baptist. I bring both of those classes right into the prison. I don't change any of the format. It's like moving from one religious institution to another.
877-962-9862 is the number to call if you want to join our discussion. Steve is on the line from Danville, Virginia. Hello, Steve.
Hello. I have a comment. I worked as a chaplain in an institutional setting about 10 years ago. And I'll tell you what always touched me is that my parishioners in the institution are a lot like my parishioners now in my appointment, except more so, you know, in terms of, you know, emotional need and impulse and problem. And what I found in the institution was that I could have folks who'd be wonderful Christians while they were inside, but as soon as they would go out, they couldn't take the step past, you know, their friends, the liquor store, et cetera, without going back into the life. And that was very sad for me.
Well, let me leave you here for a moment. I'd like to put this to Brenda and ask you, Brenda, now you've been out, I think, for 4 months or so. Is it more difficult now to practice outside than it was inside?
Yes, I think it is. I kind of liken it to while you're inside, you may be sitting down at a dinner table where there are many dishes to be served. But once you come outside, it's a smorgasbord. And there's so many choices to be made. It's so easy to fall back into the peer pressure. It's so easy to fall back into the same economic and sociological grouping. So it is tougher. But by the same token, if you have absorbed and you really are following your faith and your spirituality, you just keep relying on God, and He will do the guiding for you, and it does take a little willpower to say no.
Willpower and, I suppose, support. Steve, thank you very much for your call. What kind of support is there for folks once they get out, Marilyn?
Not much, and that's something I really would hope to see the churches start to do. Churches are wonderful about coming in and ministering in the prison walls. I wish they'd be as willing to minister when those inmates come out of prison, and they'd be there to embrace them and get them involved in their churches. I think that would make all the difference in the world. And where we've seen a little bit of it, it works.
Talking today about religious life for inmates in North Carolina's prisons, we're joined now by Bo Lozoff. Bo founded the Prison Ashram Project in 1973 with Ram Dass. Since then, he's visited and taught at more than 500 prisons around the country and the world. Bo Lozoff is also the author of the book, We're All Doing Time. Bo, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
What attracted you to the spirituality and prison ministry?
Well, I had a bunch of relatives in prison at one time or another, and when my sister's husband was doing a long sentence in the early 70s, my wife and I wound up in an ashram, which just ashram is a Sanskrit word which means house of God, literally, but practically speaking, it's a little bit a combination between an intentional community and a monastery. The difference between an ashram and a monastery is generally that people are not committed to an ashram for their entire lives, like you think of a monk or a nun professing their vocation forever. But people go into ashrams for a few years, just like people go into prison for a few years, in order to gain spiritual discipline, in order to gain understanding of themselves, in order to practice in certain confined ways. So we were living in an ashram. My brother-in-law was living in a prison, and like Reese's peanut butter cups, just the chocolate
came
peanuts
together. Well, and there certainly are similarities, obviously. If you talk about an intentional community, that's what a prison is. And if you talk about monastic life, monks do live in cells. So I guess there's they have a lot in common.
Well, at the time we visited my brother-in-law in 1972 or so, my wife and I were in this ashram. We were wearing all white. We were waking up 4 in the morning. We were working hard on a farm all day without being paid for it. We were celibate. We didn't go to movies and restaurants. We go to visit Pete in prison, the United States Penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana. He's on the farm by that time, and he's waking up at 5. He's wearing all white. He's working hard on a farm all day without getting paid for it. He's not having any sex that he wanted to talk about. And we were just struck by the similarity of the conditions, except that he would give his right arm to have the free choices that my wife and I were voluntarily giving up. So what were we getting out of it? Hmm. And that was the intriguing question. Why would we intentionally give up all of the freedoms that he was sitting around every day wishing for?
Well, and we just heard Brenda say the problem with the practice outside is precisely that, all of the choices and trying to make those judgments. Is there anything, what do you do or do you make as part of your practice when you go into prisons, some way to carry over whatever is developed inside the walls, outside?
Well, I presently live in a community here in Orange County, which is the only spiritual community I know of in the country that actually takes people out of prison as a parole plan. We've been trying for years to convince other communities, spiritual centers, ashrams, monasteries, to do the paperwork required and the commitment required to make friends with somebody while they're in prison in their last year or 6 months or so, and then be willing to receive them as a parole plan. And we just haven't found anyone else willing. So I agree with Marilyn. I wish that more churches, I wish more congregations and populations would be willing to befriend people as much when they get out as when they get in. But a healthy portion of my staff of Human Kindness Foundation are people who have spent most of their lives in prison. We've helped dozens of people, convicted killers, rapists, drug dealers, people who have genuinely changed down to their skin and bones, really changed and want to be good people. And our particular role is fairly radical. We're not talking about helping somebody just become a good law-abiding American consumer. I feel that that's part of what doesn't work.
Well, it raises the question, and Oliver Muhammad, let me put it first to you, what we're coming to here is, it sounds to me like a consensus that more needs to be done to think about life inside and life outside, and that those two worlds offer insights to each other that would inform the other quite well. Are we doing enough to bring those worlds together and to use that information?
I think much more can be done. I think in the North Carolina Department of Corrections, we have established a group called TAN. It means Transition After Care Network. And we have a chaplain on contract full-time whose specific task and job is to recruit people from the community and bring them together. And that means that these people will have access to some of the data about prisoners who will be released soon. So there is an effort on the part of North Carolina Department of Corrections to make that link.
The other side of that, too, is how much in parishes and faith communities outside prisons, some of the lessons about conversion and depth of faith could inform parishioners who have never been inside.
Well, this is one of the big problems. It's one of the big problems with the churches is that the best that we're often able to do is get a church to be willing to let in this former scumbag in the back door,
right,
as long as he or she kind of stays quiet. And and what they're not getting is that these people can be the most powerful people who work with youth at risk, who try to convince people not to follow the road that they went down. People come out of prison sometimes when it's a genuine conversion, a genuine transformation, with a tremendous amount of motivation of wanting to pay God back for the grace that saved their lives and turned them around. And we try to relegate them to the back row and just sit in the back of the bus and keep your head down and we'll let you be a member of our congregation. And we've got my staff are ex-cons. Those are the people who can help people the best.
Marilyn?
The Presbyterians have done a wonderful job in Raleigh of starting what's called a Job Start program in which they take the inmates while they're still in prison to First Presbyterian Church and try to prepare them for going out in the world, try to get them ready to take a job. And they are trying to do follow-up with these people as they actually are out on the street. And my hat's off to them. They're doing a wonderful job. But as we've all said, we need a lot more.
Well, it strikes me you face two problems from opposite ends of the spectrum here. On the one hand, you've got faith communities who feel a little bit self-righteous, perhaps, about allowing people in, as you suggest, Bill. The other side is folks who are a little nervous about allowing religious communities to take part in the conversion and improvement of society both inside and outside. Yeah. You see that as the other end of this problem, the church-state separation. We can't let these folks at our inmates.
Well, there's a lot of confusion in this area.
Yeah, right.
Well, the fact is the state of North Carolina supports ministries, and is that, you know, can that be a problem?
Well, if you look at the, I think the intent of the prison system is to reform people. Originally, they even named the names of the places, places where the Quakers, I think, had, they named it a place where folk can come and repent. So I think there's a spiritual spark in the prison. It has always been. Chaplains has been in prisons as far as back I can remember. So I think there is a respect for that part of human beings' soul, and they know that something is wrong, that something needs to happen, that somebody needs to be able to speak to that person's spirit. And regardless of all the concrete and the bars that they're, I think everybody who works in the prison know that these are human beings and they do have a soul.
877-962-9862, the number to call if you want to join our conversation today. Dennis is on the line from Durham. Hello, Dennis.
Hello. How are you folks today? I'm glad you took my call. I'm a volunteer chaplain at the Butner Federal Prison in Butner, North Carolina. And I've been volunteering there for 12 years. And we recently got a new chaplain, and he told me that because of the way that we baptized, that we would no longer be allowed to come into the prison. And one of the major problems has been that the state is tired of paying money for having to pay for chaplains. And we're talking about a voluntary service here. And I find that kind of strange.
What was it about the? Well, let me ask you first. If we're talking about baptisms, I guess that's a Christian rite. I'll put the question to you, Marilyn. Can you perform baptisms in prisons?
Yes, we can. At least when I was back at the North Carolina Correctional Center for Women, institution for women, we certainly did. Yes, we performed baptisms. I'm not sure.
Is this a state prison you're referring to?
No, it's federal.
Federal.
Well, nothing surprises me. You've got this mess, which is called the American prison system, and it's so divided. Honestly, you know, to be brutally honest, certainly at least half the people involved in administering, running the prison see religion and chaplains as a nuisance that is required by law. And I had a warden in Alabama tell me, I brought back this convicted killer who came out and lived with us for 4.5 years. I brought him back when they asked me to do a workshop at the Alabama Maximum Security Prison where he spent most of his 23 years. And I said, I'll come and do a workshop there if you let me bring him in with me. And they said, oh, no. He served time here. He can't come in. I said, well, when you want me bad enough, let me know, and because I'm bringing him with me. I finally did, and he came with me. The warden stood right in front of us. My friend is standing right next to me, a completely reformed person, converted, beautiful person. And the warden looks at me and says, well, I just want to be honest with you. I don't think that people can change. Now, he's the warden of that prison. Mm. And so you have people who consider...
You think that should be a question on your application, you know?
Yes.
Do you think people can change?
Right,
think
yes.
For that job, anyway.
But certainly in the overall American prison system, and North Carolina is probably reflective of that, certainly there's a lot of administrative opinion that we waste money and we waste time on people for whom religion may be some kind of a socially moral nice thing to do, but nothing is going to touch these people, and they're not worth it anyway. And so if we can think of a way, even if a volunteer chaplain like the caller is a volunteer, well, there's money associated with it because we have to have two correctional officers down there when they're doing a baptism, and we're tired of our funds going to that.
Yeah.
Well, Marilyn, Oliver, is that your experience?
Well, I like to, in a way, respectfully depart on that issue in the fact that I do feel that there are some officials in the Department of Corrections who are sensitive to the religious needs of the inmates, and I have to give them the props. I don't know what happens in other states, but I know North Carolina Department of Corrections has really worked hard to make sure that all inmates of all faiths have their fair share.
I didn't say all officials out there.
the sense of a mixed message, right. that they might get a powerful, might get a powerful message from many quarters, both from the guards, administration on down, that this is, you're here because you're hopeless. I mean, how prevalent is that? That sense, at least that's part of the message they may receive. Marilyn?
It exists. I'm not going to say it doesn't exist, but we certainly work at trying to weed it out. I mean, that's not the department's intention, but I'm not going to say that we don't have people that come on and have exactly that attitude.
Very briefly, what's the sense among inmates? How accepting are they of religions? Are there arguments, fights about religions? Do inmates tend to be more tolerant of various sects and religions?
I think they get a whole lot more tolerant after they're in prison because they're around it. Many of them come in having only been exposed to one particular denomination or faith, and they're suddenly thrown in with a lot of others. There are lively discussions, let's say, but I wouldn't want to actually say fights. That's a little bit strong.
Right.
All right. Well, I want to thank all of my guests today. Brenda, who joined us on the line to tell us her story about 12 and a half years in the North Carolina State Correction System, as well as Oliver Muhammad. He's coordinator of Islamic Services for the North Carolina Department of Correction. Marilyn Gaswint is chaplain at the Raleigh Correctional Center for Women. And Bo Lozoff is the founder of the Prison Ashram Project and author of the book, We're All Behind Bars.
We're all doing time, actually.
We're all doing time.
I agree with that.
That's the sequel, apparently.
That's right.
Thank you, Bo.
Thank you.
Just ahead, a trip down a country road in Chatham County. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. They say necessity is the mother of invention, and all over North Carolina, small towns that suffer from economic hardship have turned to an unlikely source to help rejuvenate their communities, the arts. In rural Chatham County, artists have moved into farmhouses, turning them into studios where they both create and sell their works. They're slowly transforming a corner of the agricultural economy into an entrepreneurial one. And an enterprising citizen of Siler City has opened a new arts incubator there that may eventually be the largest of its kind in the country. Today, we'll have two reports about the arts in Chatham County from independent producers. Alan Meredith takes us on a Chatham County arts tour, but first, Lita Hartman has a look at how Siler City is using its heritage to transform both its economy and its identity.
A generation ago, North Chatham Avenue teemed with life. Downtown Siler City was the commercial hub for the farms and factories of Chatham County and the surrounding area. Now things are a lot quieter. There are a couple of banks and social service agencies here, and several stores that cater to the town's new Latino immigrants. But most of the business has moved out to State Highway 64 on the outskirts of town.
And so over a span of years, the downtown started declining to the point where over a third of the buildings were vacant. And so it's just a matter of time before the town would just disappear.
That's Leon Tongray, director of the Small Business Center at Central Carolina Community College. Several years ago, Tongray got together with other local leaders to try to figure out how to save Siler City's downtown. The idea they came up with was pretty dramatic, to take a dozen of those vacant buildings and turn them into space for training artists and promoting their work.
That will include theater. That will include blacksmithing and glassblowing. That will include your standard painting, pottery, fiber, basketry, and those kind of things.
Tongray became the incubator's executive director. He says the project will take about $8 million and 10 years to finish. Besides studios, classrooms, and a gallery, it will also include a chocolate factory, a bakery, and a coffee kiosk, just the kinds of things that would attract well-heeled patrons from bigger cities. The whole concept is a radical departure from Siler City's blue-collar image, but Tongray says it also builds on the town's past, literally, by reusing its historic buildings.
This beautiful seat that we're sitting on came out of the hardware store that was built in 1906. We got a bank built in 1906, a livery stable, 1800s, a Methodist church building built in 1925, another Chevrolet dealership that was built in 1941.
The incubator also draws on the huge presence of self-employed artists and craftspeople who have come to Chatham County in the last few decades.
The core element are the local artists, and that's why this project was viable from the start. If you take a look at Chatham County, it's rich in the number of artists. And every day I'm amazed by someone whose name comes up that's nationally known in their particular media and is totally unknown locally. And that's almost a daily occurrence.
One of those local artists is Susan Drawn, a figure sculptor and mask maker who keeps a life-size skeleton in her studio. She got her start studying with respected potters in Seagrove, a Piedmont community west of Siler City, known for its traditional style of ceramics.
I can remember in art school there was at times a lack of appreciation for that. There was a feeling that that is not art because what you're doing is not completely and totally unique. There is a tradition there, but I felt a feeling and a pull for that tradition that was something that was passed down through time that was a thread worth holding on to.
Drawn followed that thread around the world. She studied the traditional art of Indonesia, Egypt, and Australian Aborigines before settling in Chatham County. She decided to move her studio to the Arts Incubator even before its doors opened so that she could share her experiences with others, including students. She also likes the fact that the project is giving new life to North Chatham Avenue.
And the quaint flavor of the street, as it's uplifted, it will still hold that quaint small-town flavor. And when there are more and more shopping centers that are generic-looking are popping up around, to actually see old-time southern flavor here is very refreshing.
The incubator is also attracting artists from farther afield, like Terry McInturf. McInturf's workshop is across the street from Drawn's studio in a cavernous former car dealership. He watches as his helpers plane wood for his exclusive line of electric guitars. McInturf moved his workshop to Siler City from Holly Springs when his rent increased by $1,800 a month. The rent for studio space at the incubator is a lot less. It ranges from $100 to $400, and that includes equipment, internet access, and marketing tips. For McInturf, it's a good deal.
The incubator is an ideal home for an artist such as me because it lowers my overhead. It fills in the gaps in my knowledge in terms of business and business planning and provides me with a very creative and inspiring atmosphere in which to work.
Drawn and McInturf are master artists, but the incubator also has room for Tess Janka, who's just learning.
They're working us to death, but we love it.
Janka is putting the rim and feet on a hand-built clay bowl. She spent 25 years working as a typist till carpal tunnel syndrome made her quit. Now she's in a 2-year training program in ceramics at the incubator. When she finishes, she'll have an associate's degree from Central Carolina Community College.
This will teach me everything I need to know to have my own studio, which is my goal someday. Not only am I learning the skill, but I will be learning the business side, how to sell the pottery.
For both Janka and the North Carolina Arts Incubator, the future looks promising. In 10 years, if Leon Tangray's original vision comes to pass, the incubator will employ 1,000 people in a 5-block area in downtown Siler City. Maybe then, people will be fighting over parking places on North Chatham Avenue. In Siler City, I'm Lita Hartman reporting.
This is Alan Meredith. Despite a nagging cold, last Saturday I set out to visit artists along the 12th annual Chatham Studio Tour.
I haven't seen any signs yet.
That's my friend and colleague, Jennifer. We're looking for our first stop in downtown Siler City.
Well, I'm a little turned around from the map, so I'm just hoping we're going to see North Chatham.
Traditionally a farming and textile county, the economy in Chatham has changed, but the imprint of that lifestyle remains. The countryside is dotted with small farms. In the mill towns of Siler City and Bynum, the echo of the warp and weft are barely audible.
There's the railroad tracks. That may at least help orient us.
We have the brochure with us that maps out the location of the 57 artists along the route. The tour is sponsored by the Chatham County and North Carolina Arts Councils. The artists are chosen by jury. 5 of these artists are in Siler City at the new Arts Incubator. There's also a cluster of artists near Chicken Bridge Road on either side of the Haw River. Many others dot the page, all designated with a red triangle and a number that corresponds with an actual red triangle, a number outside the artist's home or studio.
We're looking for 227.
Out on the sidewalk of Siler City, there are signs indicating tiendas and agencias, while a music store broadcasts holiday tunes. I'm eager to find ceramicist Holly Taylor, who makes these little tobacco barns. She calls them spirit houses.
What I like about the tobacco barns is, and I make them with the roof that's open, is that all of our tobacco barns are, you know, they're falling down. They're not really being used for tobacco anymore. So this is showing you, you know, the rain comes through, but they're still standing. And I guess the patterns you see on the side are, you know, how kudzu grows all over the country and grows all over trees. And the kudzu, the little patterns you see right here, is emulating the track of the kudzu, the vines. I actually saw a tobacco barn that was completely covered with kudzu, and it was just a molded green form. I'm into the beauty of the tobacco barn and sort of holding on to the legacy and the South of the tobacco barn.
Across the street, we meet Tripp Gregson, who makes furniture and home accessories from found objects. I fancy the tables made out of discarded road signs with all their markings.
There's a certain aura about people knowing that that was actually out on the road. That's like a major dent in that one. And that one really is a bullet hole. I tell the gallery, see, that's extra.
Apparently, there are about 7,000 other travelers joining us on this auto tour on these two consecutive weekends. It's a tour that will take Jennifer and I all day just to see six artists, while others move pretty quickly from stop to stop.
I guess we've been to about 10 so far. We started early, started about 10:30.
Some have a clear agenda.
I have a daughter that's a potter, so we check out the pottery and let her know what other people are doing.
While others are more spontaneous.
I just found out about this today. You know, I didn't know anything about him. I'm out visiting a friend, and he said, you know, you got this gallery thing going on. He says, go down, make a right, make a left, so I'm not even sure where I am. So I'm just kind of driving around, seeing the little signs and not knowing what I'm going to see. The really interesting part is how these folks live out here. I mean, you know, from Raleigh, and everything is so condensed, and to see how they live out here, and it's wonderful. It's great.
If you come out to Chatham to follow the studio tour, be prepared to get your car a little dusty and yourself a little lost.
Should be up on our left.
Come expecting to meet up with some interesting characters, such as the flirty gobbler, I mean a real turkey, at Siglinda Scarpa's whimsical farmhouse and ceramic studio.
Hit me, follow you.
Come prepared to see the imaginative labor of artists, such as the tile mosaic designs on the walls of Sally Erickson and Tim Bennett's studio.
You got to see this other wall. The mirrors are all reflecting gold because it's sunset, so it's even more magical right now at this time of day because of the afternoon sun. So I was up on the scaffold last night at 5:30 putting the sun rays up as it was getting dark, going, I've got to get this part up so people can really see what it's going to look like.
And it seems as if Sally and Tim's diligence has paid off.
Hey, good. You might want to look at the outside first and then go inside.
Okay.
This is sort of the big stuff is out here. We've got this wall, and then the east wall is in progress.
Okay, I'll take this one. What happens now?
The Chatham Arts Tour continues this weekend, December 11th and 12th. For maps and information, go to ChathamStudioTour, all one word, .com, or call 336-581-3763.
Producers Lita Hartman and Alan Meredith with reports on the arts in Chatham County.
Take to the highway, won't you lend me your name? Your way and my way seem to be one and the same. Mama don't understand it. She wants to know where I've been. I'd have to be some kind of natural born fool to wanna pass that bridge. skin, but you know I could feel it. On a country road.
And while you're in Chatham County, don't miss the Bynum General Store. Located a few miles north of Pittsburgh, the General Store and Post Office in this former mill town is renowned for its front porch music series. These weekly seasonal concerts began some 4 years ago as a way of drawing business to the store. The events feature acoustic musicians, usually a bluegrass band or a small alt-country group, who gather on the makeshift stage to perform for free to the 200 or so people who show up. Well, the series is in hibernation for the winter, but our director Keith Weston was there in late summer when the Williamson Brothers Band from Siler City was performing. Here's what he heard in and around the Bynum General Store.
Three bubble gums and one ring pop. Is that it? All right, 67 cents.
That's awesome.
There you go. Have a dollar?
Yeah, keep the change.
Can't chocolate milk no more, huh? We hadn't had milk in 2 years. Milk men quit
about
us.
How long have I been gone? This trip.
Close the bridge on us, it's too far to come around. I do it for, I guess it's two reasons. Stubbornness, too stubborn to quit. And the older people that's here, that has mailboxes here, I kind of do it for them to keep the Bynum name here and keep them in place to get their mail. We still have the Bynum post office. We still have our own zip code.
Good evening. Welcome to Bynum. Let's give a big round of applause for the moment we're working.
Sounds this past summer from the Bynum General Store music series, as recorded by WUNC's Keith Weston. The music series will return to the store next spring. Today, that's the state of things. Thanks for listening. Drop us an email at sot@wunc.org. Support for the state of things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Frank Stachow.